Good morning and welcome. My name is Brian Field, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum today, with today's guest speaker, Dr. Bernd Heinrich. Please join me in thanking our musician today, Mary Beth Hallam. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR two Sundays from now at 9 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within the next few days. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, the speakers have agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions towards the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall through the door to your left. There you will have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. You've been provided with a blue card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list. You can either mail the blue card to us or drop it in the bowls alone or with your contribution to the sustainability of the Monadnock Lyceum. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. So we deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls, in the church, and in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Dr. Bernd Heinrich. Dr. Heinrich began his career as an insect physiologist, but as he has matured, he's expanded his field of interest to include the behavioral adaptations of organisms to climate extremes. Dr. Heinrich is impressive as a meticulous observer of nature who not only observes, but asks questions and then designs experiments to find answers to those questions. Thus, he combines the very best attributes of the old-time naturalist with the modern investigative researcher. He is Emeritus Professor of Behavioral Ecology at the University of Vermont, ultra-marathon record holder, the man who won the Boston Marathon's Masters Division on his 40th birthday, author of 18 books, keen observer and talented artist, naturalist and scientist extraordinaire. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the man the New York Times called the Dumbledore of the Forest, Dr. Bernd Heinrich.
Thank you for coming. I've never been up in a pulpit before, so it's going to be quite an experience. And thank you for that introduction about me having questions and then having experiments. Actually, my title today, Nature the Panacea, is a question. I don't have any experiment to prove that. So I confess I really don't have any answer to this question today. But when I was asked to give the title, I just kind of thought, well, all good things come from nature, and something will come up. It's a general topic that is quite relevant. But then I thought again, well, this is quite trivial, so what am I really going to be talking about? So it was quite a puzzle what I would go, and but then I thought of an incident. A dear friend of mine who was in the audience was walking down the street in Portland, Oregon, this last winter, walking a dog, and suddenly she felt really kind of weak and suddenly couldn't get a breath and was wheezing and couldn't get any air, and then collapsed on the pavement. And she was saved because she got to the doctors in time and they did the correct thing. Now, I was thinking, if they had done the wrong thing, she would not be here today. That would be the situation with many of us as well. And the question then entered my mind, we know that they did the right thing, but the question is, was it really also a moral thing? So obviously we think of the right thing in this case with regard to knowledge. If they had made a mistake and it had been wrong, we would not think them immoral. They just had imperfect knowledge. But imperfect knowledge never needs to be as imperfect as it often is in practice. So it seems to me we can also consider whether or not having that knowledge is related to it as a moral issue, if it is based on wrong belief, belief that detracts from knowing the reality of nature as it is. Panacea comes from the Greek mythology, from Panacela, the goddess of universal remedy. She was said to have a lotion that could heal the sick, presumably of all diseases. So now we think of Panacea as figuratively to solve a large number of problems. Well, there are always a large number of problems, and it's no longer possible to go to Delphi and consult the gods and hear the authoritatively spoken solutions. That was all there was at that time. To heal the sick, we now realize that we have to, first of all, figure out how the body works. There are no shortcuts. And that brings me back to my friend here. She had suffered a pulmonary embolism, which basically means that there was a huge blood clot in the artery in the lung, and it stopped the circulation, and so there was no oxygen going to the vital organs. So the doctors had quickly recognized these symptoms and applied the right remedies. So knowledge is a very precious thing, and it helps us do the right thing. So for millions of years, we were totally ignorant of this knowledge about the blood circulation. If it had happened earlier, death would have been certain. We had even no clue that the blood circulates at all. It wasn't until the English physician, William Harvey, who figured out the circulation of the blood, and in 1628, he famously wrote, De motu cordis et sanguinis in animalibus. And as an aside, I actually read it when I was at UCLA back in 1968, when I was trying to figure out how sphinx moths regulated their body temperature. And it turned out they do it by blood circulation. So that's why I read that 1628 paper by William Harvey, because I want to get back to the basics to see if he said anything about insects. Well, he didn't. So he didn't directly help me on my project, but the results of what he found about nature now, centuries later, has saved millions of lives, because we know more precisely what is. It's absolutely clear that we can never be perfect, but we can now come closer to doing the right thing. And I believe in just about everything. Why? Because our knowledge of nature has exploded. So the question is nature then a standard of morality? I think morality, the standard of behavior, have since ancient times been based on beliefs and not on nature. To see what the world of belief looks like, let's step back to the Stone Age past. And I think we can do that. We can go to Australia and see what the ancestral human condition was like. The reason Australia is good for that, because Australia was isolated from basically all human knowledge that was exchanged throughout the world for a long time. And so there was an expedition to Arnhem Land in northern Australia in 1948, and they tried to find out what the past was by studying the Aboriginal cultures. At that time, their world was explained by witch doctors. Now, witch doctors were people acknowledged to have power that others didn't have. And that power came from presumed knowledge, and this was due to the fact of the absence of real knowledge. So the absence of real knowledge was counteracted by unseen spirits who cured the sick. And so individual people had weak medicine. For example, in one tribe, you could prevent sickness by singeing your hair off. So that was a belief. It just was wrong. So, but anyways, you could do that individually, but normally you'd have to consult the witch doctor because there's some things that were not so simple as just singeing off your hair. So just to show you a little bit of what this world was like that basically we lived in, because this is a culture that, a similar culture that all of us were at one time in. By us, I mean Homo sapiens. We're not the least bit different from them. We just have culture added onto our lives. But otherwise, if you put us back into that situation, we would believe exactly the same thing. We would do exactly the same things. So here's an example of just what it might look like. I was just reading Adam and Ochre by Colin Simpson, a book in 1967. And he, in his book, I'll just give you one little instant in time. He talks about this witch doctor named Anduro, and who was summoned by Nabanja to avenge the death of his baby son, who was born dead. So Nabanja thinks that Anduro, the witch doctor, has a strong mind and has the power to affect the evil spirit. So Nabanja knows that the death had been done by a bad spirit. He knows that. So now he wants to get even. And to do that, he has to consult the witch doctor and see how it's going to be done. So Anduro now begins this work. He mixes charcoal with red ochre in holes in a rock. These holes were made long ago by the Namaran, the Thunder Man, back in the dream time. And so he plucks a twig from a tree and he chews the end of it and use it as a brush. And then he dips it into the hole in the rock with charcoal and red ochre, and then he starts drawing a picture on the wall, and he draws a woman with very, very thin legs, and then while he's drawing, he's hissing through his mouth, and he's drawing her with a snake head. So Nabanja, who summoned this witch doctor, thinks he's doing a great job, because obviously he's doing a creepy figure like that. It's going to be very powerful magic. Anyway, right after the figure is drawn, it's still not active yet. It has to be activated, and so the witch doctor has to sing the figure to make it active. So this is a detail that can be done at a later convenient time. So you can see it's a very complicated world, and it takes a lot of imagination to find your way around that and to be effective and watch out for all these spirits. But actually, death in this culture wasn't such a bad thing, because the Wing Malong, the spirit inside you, assumed such a huge role. So the body was merely a vesicle for the spirit, so when someone dies, they quickly buried him and there was no big deal about it. But the spirit now was running around and could potentially harm, because it might get upset and it might inhabit some relatives. It might get invictive and make him sick. About a month later, they had to have a big ceremony where the witch doctor was again consulted to try to chase the spirit away. Actually, they had spirits in the animals too, and that suggested the proper behavior toward them. So that was their morality. They had to treat them right. For example, if you were in Arnhem Land and you were in the Wowgate clan, everybody knows that, you know, the spirits are in the frogs, so you could never harm a frog. But if you spear a goose, for example, as Nabanja did, and it was not yet dead, he broke its wings so he could sling it over his arm so it wouldn't flop around so much. It was still throwing his head all around, but that wasn't so inconvenient. He just didn't know that he was causing it pain and suffering. It had nothing to do with not harming animals. But the point is here that Nabanja was no different than any of us if we had been born into that culture. So it was his imagination that was driving him, and he had no facts to go by. So he had no concept that, for example, that after you strip the fur and feathers off, that this animal had pain receptors, that it had feelings, that it had emotions that corresponded to those of many of us. To him, it was put in the category of food. And so he kept it alive so to keep the meat from spoiling, because he had it in a long way to carry it home. So many beliefs especially were related to creation, how the world was made. So in their world, the world was created by the rainbow serpent from the long time ago, which they called the dream time. He made the rivers run and so on, and then he crawled back into the earth where it's been ever since. Of course, Indians in the Northwest, they thought the world was made by raven. But creation myths are endless because they are based on imagination, which is boundless, as is our ability to stitch them to beliefs. So we call these creation myths, mostly because they're different from our beliefs. A week ago, I found a little thing stuck on my windshield on my truck, and it said, Mr. H, what do you think of this Behe fella who wrote Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution, in support of intelligent design? So this was not in 1696. This was in 1996 that Behe wrote this book. So Behe claims that biochemical complexity is so great that it precludes evolution. So of course, what this Behe fella, Michael J. Behe, is really trying to say is that there therefore is special creation, which is different from scientific story of creation. So basically he's saying God made it, and that's it. But, you know, that said though, when I hear the science creation story, it does sound also surreal to me. I mean, it's namely this, that about, I think it's 14.5 billion years ago, there was basically nothing, and then from an infinitely small space, smaller than a molecule or whatever, some sort of baseball, I mean, nobody has any idea, then suddenly there was this big explosion, and that put the galaxies out there, millions of galaxies, and as far as we can see, there are millions, billions more galaxies. So imagine, you know, creating something from nothing and creating so much from nothing. It seems to defy the laws of physics. So I'm surprised somebody hasn't said that there is irreconcilable complexity in the evolution, you know. It doesn't make any sense. But I think, you know, there is a huge difference, though. And what I'm trying to say is it's not a mere fact. So my belief in the Big Bang, as far as it goes, and I believe it with a grain of salt, I always keep wondering if something got the equation wrong somewhere. Basically, it's a collective work of scientists throughout the ages, and with the use of the most incredible eyes that have seen into the heart of the atom and to predict their behavior and to use it in a million ways, and those eyes are instruments, have seen the billions of galaxies beyond our own and seen them interacting in various stages of formation, from gas clouds to exploding supernovae. And all this shows, incidentally, that it's not something the Earth was made in 7 days to provide a home for man, as millions have believed and some still do. And it includes knowing the laws of gravity, energy, and light. So one might ask, why should anyone care what anyone or everyone believes? Why does it matter? Well, I think beliefs have consequences. They may be right, they may be wrong, they may be indifferent, they may be harmful and even toxic. I mean, Hitler and his gang promulgated the belief that some groups of people, for some unspecific reason, are superior to others. And that notion flies against everything we know about biology, totally wrong. And there were, of course, many other wrongs as well, because they fly against any reality. So another one of the beliefs, which was almost elevated to a religion, it was communism as well, which also sought converts through trying to legitimize some kind of science. The problem was it was, again, wrong. And it was perverted science, perverted biology, pseudoscience, just like special creation. Based on some facts, there were perhaps some arguments that could be made for communism in the sense that they always tried to relate it to some facts, but not all of them. So we seek meaning in a social sense. We have a sense of belonging to groups, and we want to do whatever we can to help. So there's a community effort, cooperation ingrained in us. And that is a fact of life, this feeling of helping, because it's been a selective pressure, but basically for competition, for one group competing against another. But if this is extrapolated without bounds, you get something very much different. For example, in the Stalinist Russia, it was not allowed to own property, and as a consequence, in a very, very large, boundless group, whatever you did had no effects on anyone, and there were no consequences. And there was no advantage to doing any striving, and so as a result, it collapsed. It was basically an unplanned experiment showing what was wrong, because it didn't work. It was wrong. So I think another kind of a toxic belief that is still kind of floating around, and maybe wrong and also toxic, is that we think that it's a belief that we humans are superior to all other animals, and that we were a special creation put on Earth during the creation which was for us. So it's okay to lord it over all, that the Earth was made specifically for us. So some might say, so what? This is a quaint idea, but what harm is there to think that? Well, I think there's plenty. I mean, namely, it has the potential of obliterating large swaths of life. Populations of rhinos, elephants, birds of paradise, whales, whippoorwills, each requires an ecosystem to exist, and each ecosystem contains tens of thousands of species in composite, the highest order created on Earth. And ultimately, in the long run, we depend on it. So ultimately, the sense of belonging is something that we need. We need meaning. We need a rapport and union. And often, it's said to be with God. Or is it what we call nature? It seems to me there's kind of a fuzzy distinction between the two. And I just read Erasmus Kolak in his famous 1984 book called The Embers and the Stars. He seems to struggle semantically between what he calls God and what he called nature. He states that arguments of the existence of God have always been bootless. They have always appealed to some insight or other. That's all we know of God. But then he argues that people, quote, recover a sense of God's presence by living close to nature, such as through organic farming and other folk ways. But he finally concludes with a bold statement. God is. There is a moral law. The human dwells in the nature that is God's poem, at the intersection of time and eternity. I think that's a sufficiently vague to weasel out of any commitment, but my sense is that nature to him is the living presence of God. But I wonder if that's the case, what does the word God add to it? I think that maybe his notion is that nature, if it's just a poem, quote, with no theology to teach, because he supposes moral choices are only those dictated by something external to reality. But maybe it's the opposite. Maybe he has a lot to teach us. Maybe nature has a theology. Maybe it has a lot to teach us. We have to be true to reality. It teaches us, for example, that you don't cure tuberculosis by chasing the wingerling spirit off with the help of the witch doctor, painting pictures on a rock, or the Aztecs who cut the hearts out of living victims on a rock to make the sun rise. The thing is, they didn't even know what the sun is. So if they knew what the sun is, then they would have a theology that would be quite different than this belief. What do we actually know, and why? How do we know anything? Well, you and I know that gravity exists, right? Even though nobody has ever seen it, with no more empirical evidence than the Aztecs, we know gravity exists. Before Newton, the dropping of an apple from the tree was nothing very remarkable. To us, it's the most amazing thing. Why? Because we don't take it for granted. We look at it. But you and I can now test it at any moment. I just tested it with the water. It just went straight down. It went straight down toward the center of the earth. That's where it was headed, if it could, if there wasn't an opposing force. And so gravity actually pulls between every object in the universe. Gravity is very different on the moon than it is on Earth. So it makes logical sense that if gravity interacts between all objects of the universe, pretty soon the whole universe should collect in one big ball, right? It should all aggregate together. That's how suns are made, that's how galaxies are made, and why doesn't the whole universe collect into one ball? Well, I think that supports the logic of the Big Bang, because that is expanding it. Maybe it will collapse again at some time. That's what physicists now think. So we also know that light is part of the what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. I'm personally totally incapable of even comprehending what light is. It just does not make any common sense. Here are photons, whatever they are, and they're in waves, and their energy, I don't know what any of that means, and here they're traveling at the same speed through air, which is fairly dense relative to the vacuum. It's still going at the same speed. And I just Googled it, and it said the speed of light is, of the electromagnetic spectrum is I got to read this, it's 299,792,458 meters per second. So if you translate into more possibly understandable times, it basically means at a speed of about 8 times around the Earth in 1 second. So can you understand that? I can't. But, you know, this light now has been traveling we measure some that's been traveling what we figure for 10 billion years before it reached us, because telescopes can detect those distant galaxies. And we know they're receding because we know that we see the redshift. So part of the electromagnetic spectrum, it's not just light. I mean, there is X-rays and radio waves. And so right now, all of us are being bombarded with radio waves from VPR and New Hampshire Radio and Paris and London and Rome. It's all around us all the time. It's right here. And how do we know? Well, get a radio and you can just plug it in and you can get the station. Those electromagnetic waves are being converted to, with the input of energy, they're converted to electrical signals, and that's converted to sound waves, something totally different. So we don't see these things, but we know they exist because we have proof all the time right around us, and this proof is based on the knowledge that has accumulated for centuries. So what about living things, though? They are, of course, much, much more complex, and so this idea of a biochemical, it's so complex that it couldn't possibly evolve, that you look at it and there's no way to understand it. Well, life is very much different. We can't really explain it in terms of just biochemistry and physics. So that's why it seems really mysterious. But we have to remember that each organism is actually history. It's a history that has accumulated since the dawn of time. What's that? They think on Earth about 3.5 billion years. So basically, life is information added onto the physics. So life is analogous to what's written in a book, and the physics is the paper. So it's much more complex than the paper. It's the information. And we know when books are written, there are mistakes. The author makes mistakes, and of course the printers always make mistakes, and then there's autocorrect, and that makes mistakes. But that's really, as far as life is concerned, that's where innovation comes in. Innovation comes from changes. And so, to quote Leonard Cohen's famous song line, where the light comes in, it's these cracks. So there is a copying mechanism. The physical copying mechanism is the DNA that's passed on. So that's really what's immortal. So life changes. It changes constantly. And despite our differences, we know now we are very much alike. We and other animals, we have solved similar problems in different ways. And all of this suggests that there are consistent processes operating in nature that encourage us to see the real and hence to provide reason for choice. Let's look at something possibly as it relates to politics, for example. And I bring this example up because I worked with bumblebees and that ended up being taken for politics. So I studied bumblebees for many years. I captured them, the behavior, and I put little tags on them. Here's blue number 3, and followed them in the field. And I started following bees when they first came out of the hive for the very first time, totally naive bees. And I found basically that the bees, when they first leave the hive, are very dumb. They don't know one flower from another, which is food and which is nectar. But they sample all kinds of flowers, and then they gradually become specialized, and they learn how to manipulate different flowers. It takes very different behavior to get nectar out of a monk's hood, which has the nectar hidden in specific nectaries hidden way up in the flower, versus getting pollen from a carrot flower with an inflorescence they have to scrape over. So they learn, and then everyone forages from a different flower eventually, and so they bring the honey back to the hive, a nice warm place, and they're protected, and so everyone benefits, because basically what they're doing is trading their skills. While one is specialized to get nectar from one flower, one pollen from another. This was taken in a 1990 book, Bionomics, Inevitability of Capitalism, to represent what Adam Smith said about human economy. But basically, what the bees were doing was not trading money, which is the product of the skills, but here they're trading honey instead for their own self-interest, and the invisible hand was working for the good of the all. But anyway, he has this analogy, but there's one thing wrong with it. First off, that if this is great for capitalism, we have to remember that in the bee colony, all of the bees except the queen were sterile. They were basically castrated. So I don't know if he meant that everyone in a capitalist society should be castrated, all except for the CEO, but he left that part out. So, and then there's also the environment. The bees were collecting nectar and pollen, and they were promoting plant growth because they're helping the reproduction of the environment. And so in this capitalist situation where they are now corporations rather than individuals, which actually, by the way, the Supreme Court, I understand, thinks of a whole corporation with millions of people or thousands is one individual. So again, you know, it's very, very different, and the analogies don't really work unless you cherry pick. So basically, What I'm trying to say is, I think a simple panacea in nature that can solve all our problems is wishful thinking. I think the unknown keeps growing along with the known. So the belief, the stock and trade of the witch doctor is part of our biological syndrome for short-term survival. Animals or nature in general show us what is and what is possible, and they can help illuminate our paths and guide choices. They do have relevance to what is right and what is wrong for long-term success. I think basically everyone has good intentions, but that does not guarantee moral. I think intentions are too often based on beliefs, and beliefs we tend to overrate as being moral, but the reality of nature is so complex that we use beliefs basically as a shortcut to reality. And I don't think there really is a shortcut to the real. And I think the real then is the basis of all right and wrong. Thank you very much.